When I was about 9 or 10, my grandmother came to visit us from Vancouver Island. And I was very much in favor of this because, well, I was her favorite grandchild, which meant I got a lot of attention. But probably the most notable thing about this visit was that shortly after she arrived, a giant present ended up under the Christmas tree. Of course, I had to investigate. And so I don't know, it was in some early morning or late at night, I crept up to the tree and looked at the card, recognizing my grandmother's handwriting and my name written on it. I spent many a morning trying to assess what could be in this giant package. I went up to it, feeling its heft, trying to shake it, see if there was any clue as to what was going on inside. Nothing. The anticipation was growing. And so when Christmas morning came and I had to pick which present I was going to open first, there was no question in my mind which one I was going for. I beelined to that giant package on the right side of the tree. And I unwrapped the wrapping paper. I couldn't even see. I was so excited. And I found a box of laundry detergent. But I know my grandmother is very good at reusing things. She grew up in the Depression, after all, so I persevered. I opened the top of the laundry detergent box and looked inside, and there was a bag. And so I pulled out the bag, and I dumped the contents of the bag on the ground, and I found a beautiful, beautiful set of navy blue sheets. My grandmother had got her favorite 9-year-old grandson sheets for Christmas. And I acted like most ungrateful 9 or 10-year-olds would by throwing a temper tantrum. I couldn't in that moment collect myself and remind myself that my very atomic existence was an improbable miracle for which I should be grateful. Or that I had just been gifted a very practical and usable gift for which my parents were probably thankful. I couldn't even bring myself to think about my grandmother's feelings as the tears came down and the anger spewed. But my grandmother took it in stride, never holding that outburst against me. She graced me with something that I didn't deserve in that moment, compassion. If Gretchen started her sermon last week about covenant talking about betrayal, I have to start this week speaking about grace and gratitude. Because without grace, we cannot speak about covenant. Traditionally, though, grace is understood as this free and unmerited favor that some God gives to us humans, usually manifested in some salvation for us in a life after. But as you might imagine, that's not the grace that I'm talking about today. The grace I want to talk about is more humanistic, more experiential. And I think the clearest way for us to get access to grace is through the practice of gratitude. For gratitude smashes open the forgotten and taken for granted aspects of our lives, peeling open the everyday and leaving us in awe of all that we have been given, all that is possible, all that goes on beyond our control and power. The work and struggle of our ancestors and families who worked to bring us to this very moment. The ecosystems of the world that grant us nourishment. Like the jaws of life, gratitude can find grace amongst the smashed up wreckage of our world. Even the worst Christmas presents. Gratitude opens the most basic experience of grace. That feeling of awe that we are simply alive, that that didn't need to happen, and that we were not only given life, but we were given this life, your life. Even in all its complexities, put the power of gratitude on the case, and I challenge anyone not to find grace in the midst of our beautiful, broken human entanglements, for better or for worse. The present is a gift from our ancestors. And when we sit back and contemplate the improbability of this moment, of atoms swirling, the offerings of ancestors, parents, friends in this earth, the question that naturally arises from that experience of gratitude, the question that wells up from that feeling of grace is, what should we do with this gift? What should we do with this life? And that question, I would argue, is the most radical question that a human could ever ponder. Adam and Eve wrestled with that question in the garden. They made a choice. I think they made the right choice, by the way. Giving up a life in utopia as some sort of demigods, striking out into the unknown, taking the more meaningful path of freedom, knowledge, and consequence. But if I remember correctly, not everyone agreed with me. Our lives, like theirs did, form a response to that question: what shall we do with the gift of life? Watch my life, and I'll show you, is their response. Now, the culture of our time would like us not to think of life as a gift, but rather as a given. Displacing from the center of our lives gratitude for greed, conditioning us to ask, what do I want? Irrespective of the web of life to which the impact of our choices will be felt, you can feel the tendrils of that question, what do I want, creeping out, or at least I can. They sneak in, reprioritizing, changing us, moving us away. The moments I feel most like myself are not moments in which I am asking the question, what do I want? As Reverend Scott Taylor writes, our religion invites us to ask not what do I want, but rather whose am I? Two very different questions that lead us to two very different lives. Which question will we invite to lead us? Every single sacred text says our choice is literally a matter of life and death. Whose am I? Whose am I is the covenantal response to the question of what shall we do with this gift of life, where what do I want is the individual one, the individualistic one. Whose am I shifts the question. As Douglas Steer, a Quaker writer, writes, whose am I extends the question beyond the little self-absorbed self and wonders, who needs you? Who loves you? To whom are you accountable? Who are the people, the beings, the ideals to which my ultimate loyalty and love are bound? And what does that demand of my life? Asking whose am I unearths the bonds of connection that connect all that we know to all that we don't. It is a question that extends both to the past and to the future, for we are caught in the present, which makes claims on us from both sides. Whose am I is the question that unearths at its core the covenant that we have with life itself. In 1839, the Jesuit priests who ran Georgetown University had a problem. The college was struggling financially and needed a quick cash infusion to stay afloat. Lucky for them, two of their presidents stepped in to save the day, and they convinced the school to sell 272 of their enslaved persons, the slaves that the school owned, who had been donated by wealthy patrons. That sale netted them $3.3 million in today's currency, about $12,000 a person. And it saved the school from bankruptcy. Whose are we? It took Georgetown 200 years to truly wrestle with that question, for they announced this week that they would begin giving preferential admissions treatment to the descendants of those enslaved persons. Deciding now, after all of those years, that those enslaved people had a claim on them, that they had a covenant, they had an obligation to live their life anew. It's the same question that this nation is struggling with when the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota stand up and say that a pipeline should not cross their land. Whose are we? Are we special interests, environmentalists, tribal nations, the Earth's loves? Whose are we? Ever since I moved to the United States, I have been asked the same question over and over and over again. What do you miss most about Canada? And while I could say that it's Tim Hortons, or that I miss not being made fun of for saying sorry or sorrow with that O, not the A, I can't get the A. It always sounds like I'm making fun of people. Sorry. Sorrow. I could say that I miss being able to be consistently given a proper steeped cup of tea. But probably the most profound loss since I moved to the United States was a covenantal one. It was the loss of a deep grounding and feeling of whose I was. Now, don't get me mistaken. What I experienced was not some patriotic weakness caused by suddenly being surrounded by stars and stripes. It was a profound sense that I had no idea the history of this place and where I fit into its unfolding story. A story that I have yet to feel fully includes me. When I looked at the struggles that America faces, my overwhelming reaction was to run away and disconnect. Not because I wanted to return to some socialist utopia up north, but because the problems and overwhelming struggles that people face in Canada felt like my problems. They had a claim on my heart that even in a country littered with brokenness, I had a sense that that was my brokenness. My heart was broken open by it because I had a stake in that game for the long haul. Ever since I moved to this country 4 years ago, it was all too easy for me to retreat into my own desires and play a bystander. But as we approached the final stage of my visa being approved, hopefully, and the reality that I've fallen in love with an American, and that I'm beginning to fall in love with the congregation that I've had the privilege of getting to know this past month, the question of whose am I is coming to lovingly haunt me once again. Because I think the spirit of life is asking me to expand my answer. We're caught in the middle of a story. That's what life is. We're caught in the middle of a story that began way, way before us. Our job, our simple job in this life is to keep answering the question, whose are we, with expanding waves. Waves that move back to the past. Waves that move and crash into the future. Waves that begin to include people who look and think not like us. To take up that covenant with life itself, means to resist the forces that tell us that the only thing that matters is what we want, that we can be content to sit on the sidelines. We must resist them and ask that question which forces us to forge relationships beyond ourselves and be changed and transformed by what we find. My prayer is that we become conspirators with the forces of love and never again, and never again have my own heart hardened into myself. For we are not our own. Hurtling forth from the stardust of creation, we've arrived to life already caught in a web of beings. Gifted life. Stories are pressed upon our souls, imprinting on us memories and moments which make claims on us, asking us to conspire with the forces of love. We are not our own. We are not our own. This earth, this life has formed us, and thank goodness for it. We are not alone. Called and named, the journey of self always winds its way to others' doors. Invite them along, for we could always have more companioning voices to remind us in the times that seem dark that we are not alone, that we are not alone. Therefore, let us make thanksgiving for the past we had no part in, but the future becomes ours to briefly hold. We rejoice in a raucous choir, thanksgiving for this moment, for this chance to become the ancestors of a future not our own, for the grace that inhabits stars and souls, and gratitude that guides us through. Let us make thanksgiving. Our culture says that life is not a gift, but a given. Replacing our gratitude with greed, it seduces us with the question, what do I want? It is for us to keep renewing our covenant with life, to help each other expand the horizons of we until one day, or maybe even for a moment, it enfolds every single being. Amen. And blessed be.